Case number 73143, Dunham versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Brown representing the appellant, Mr. Casper representing the state. And we also have Justice Pickering, as you can see, in Las Vegas. So she'll probably have some questions for both of you during the course of the arguments. So I think hopefully our video works fine. It worked fine on our last argument we did at 1:30. So, Ms. Brown, are you ready to proceed? Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Christine Brown, appearing on behalf of John Dunham, the appellant. May it please the court. This is an appeal from a jury verdict in a criminal case. Mr. Dunham was charged with two counts of information. One of them was home invasion. The other one was a burglary for events that occurred on October 25th through 26th, 2016. It was alleged that he unlawfully entered a condominium located at 211 in State Line, Nevada. This property was owned by his estranged wife at the time, Tricia Stripko. At trial, he was found guilty of the home invasion charge, but not guilty of the burglary. The facts that led up to this case were that Tricia Stripko and Mr. Dunham were married in November 2012. They were still married, estranged, when these crimes occurred in October 2016. From 2014 to 2016, they leased an apartment together in Monterey, California. Both of them were on that lease. Ms. Stripko was a neurologist at a nearby hospital and worked there throughout the year. In October 2015, Ms. Stripko purchased the condominium on Olympic Court up in State Line, Nevada. The testimony and evidence at trial was she purchased this in her own name and that she alone paid for the property.
Was that condo, is that in Tahoe Village up there?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
The month after they purchased the condominium, the pipe froze and causing a lot of damage. Although they were able to visit it occasionally, they had to have some repairs done and also had some remodeling done. So there was construction going on from like January 2016 until May of 2016. During this time frame, Mr. Dunham leave from Monterey, go up to the condominium, stay a week or more at a time, where he would sometimes help Mr. Lachasse, who was doing the repairs, do those repairs. Ms. Stripko testified she only came up occasionally on the weekends. In June of 2016, Mr. Dunham and Ms. Stripko separated. This occurred while they were both staying. They were at the condominium. Ms. Stripko returned to her apartment, to her home in Monterey, and Mr. Dunham remained at the condominium. He remained there throughout the summer, making only occasional trips to Monterey. On August 23rd, 2016, while he was in Monterey, he was served with a restraining order that prohibited him from contacting Ms. Stripko. It also excluded him from both the residence in Monterey and the residence at Lake Tahoe. Ms. Stripko testified at trial that even though there was this restraining order in effect, she did not go to the condominium from August to October 21st of 2016. She did go up there on October 21st. She arrived in the evening and she left morning of October 23rd. From October 23rd to February 2017, when the trial was, she testified she did not stay at the condominium, although she'd been there occasionally to check on things. Mr. Dunham was, at times that we know of, as we brought out a trial occasionally up in Tahoe, and on August 31st, 2016, about a week after he was served with a restraining order, there was a deputy that contacted him. He was at the condominium. The deputy advised him that there was a restraining order in place, that he was excluded from that property. On October 21st, the day that Ms. Dunham had come up, after her long absence, Mr. Dunham was found in the condominium. At that time, she had called sheriff's deputies just to have an welfare safety check done on the condominium before she arrived to make sure he was not there. The officers didn't locate him in the residence, and he was concealed under the bed, had an unloaded shotgun in his hand. At this point, he was arrested. This was on October 21st. He was in custody during the time that she spent her brief period at the condominium in Tahoe. On October 25th, he appeared in Tahoe Justice Court. He was released on his own recognizance with bail conditions, written bail conditions that were introduced at trial. Again, advising him to have no contact with the strip co, and also prohibiting him from going to the condominium in the state office. On October 26th, when workers came to that condominium in the morning, they did locate Mr. Dunham again in the condominium. He was asleep in the upstairs loft, and he was arrested at that time. It was this last incident, the October 25th, October 26th date, that was the issue that went, or the case that went forward to trial. The allegation was that the locks had been changed on the condominium window and entered unlawfully, and that's where the home invasion came from.
Okay. Ms. Brown, if I can interrupt you, I think the court has a good understanding of the facts. I think the legal question perhaps the court wanted to hear the argument was the proposed jury instruction you gave on the definition of reside. And do you think that was a correct statement of law that in that proposed jury instruction you submitted to Judge Young, which she did not approve?
Your Honor, I think it's a correct statement of law based on this instruction was itself taken from a Wisconsin case. It was no Nevada case giving such an instruction. It was Petrowski. And so it was pretty much verbatim from that jury instruction in that case. In looking at other cases, either looking at domestic violence cases, even these cases, the case law would look to residing as some type of continuous arrangement, not just a sporadic thing. And then even looking at, and these were pointed out in the reply brief, of even definitions from different legal dictionaries, all look to some type of continuous living relationship, living arrangement, to say a person resided there. It wasn't, again, a sporadic event. And in this case, the court, even though it rejected the instruction, it didn't say this is an incorrect statement of the law. The judge did not say it's an incorrect statement of the law. It was more, there's a plain meaning for this word, and so if there's a plain meaning, I'm not going to define it for the jury. You're free to argue that. But the plain meaning is basically, in the legal dictionaries, the plain meaning would be something living in a continuous, longer-term situation. So I think it was a correct statement of the law. I think it possibly could have been cleaned up a bit, changed if there was something the state objected to, and that would have been one of the remedies that was offered under Crawford, is if there's a jury instruction that carries the what the defense is in the case.
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your thought, Ms. Brown.
Then the instruction can at least be crafted so that it carries more accurate definition as viewed by the court, the state, and defense working together, but it just can't be eliminated altogether. So I think it was...
I understood your argument in the district court to be that, as set forth in your proposed jury instruction and consistent, and you argued that, in fact, to the jury. I read the transcript where you'd argued this, even though the judge hadn't given the instruction. You argued the same concept. And the concept, as I understand it, from your point of view, is that for the home invasion crime to occur under the definition of inhabited dwelling, that it's a permanency. This is a permanent residence. But what do you make of the language in the statute itself, which, first of all, makes reference to the owner or other lawful occupant, which kind of implies it could be inconsistent as long as they're lawfully showing up there, and the list of dwellings that are referenced, tents, trailers, boats, motorhomes, travel trailers. I suppose one can have permanent residence in a motorhome or a travel trailer, but a tent or a boat gets to a little far afield. I mean, homeless people, I suppose, have a permanent residence in a tent. But I think that the implication of this is that reside is describing, the word reside in this context is describing these various items as being used as a residence, not necessarily the same as a domicile, a permanent domicile. Why shouldn't we interpret it in that manner?
If it were, I mean, I think the thing is, even though everybody says there's a plain meaning of the word reside, it can be, you know, a technical interpretation of, you know, legal residence as opposed to domicile. You can get into all those really legal definitions. The other way to look at it is it goes down to, if you're looking at when they define reside, a lot of times they slip into just using residence. And so it can go down to something as low as using it's residential as opposed to commercial property. So I think there's a large, it doesn't have a simple plain meaning, and so I think there needed to be a jury instruction on that. I think the fact that they chose to use the term reside, I think it does mean living there and some type of continuous thing, but it's not just an abandoned property or not. And if you look,
if we were to accept your definition, then in effect, anybody who had a second home, you couldn't commit the crime of home invasion on a second home, or you couldn't commit the crime of home invasion probably for most boats or house trailers because they're not permanent residences by and large. Do you think that's what the legislature had in mind?
I'm not saying it has to be a permanent residence. I'm saying it has to be a place where you live. And so there has to be some kind of continuation of being there, being basically on the property, your stuff's there, something like that. That way a tent can be your residence. You can reside in a tent if you're living in the tent, if your stuff is in the tent, if the tent basically is considered your home. When your tent's put in your closet, it can't be called a residence.
And it may be jury instruction, though. And the argument that you made to the jury was more permanent than that, wasn't it? I mean, you had argued for a jury instruction that would have defined residence as required the person to dwell in the residence continuously and permanently. So
I think that's continuously or permanently. And I think a lot of this jury instruction has disjunctives in it as opposed to conjunctives. So the idea that a person keeps or returns to a dwelling is some for legal work. So it can be a number of different things. So I think that would be broad enough to work with the statute in this situation. That does require some type of continuous arrangement.
Did the judge's refusal to give the jury instruction in this case, was that harmless error because you were able to argue precisely what you wanted him to include in the instruction and the jury rejected that position by finding your client guilty of home invasion?
I don't think it was harmless error because in one, arguments of attorneys don't carry the weight of a judge. And so if a judge is saying this is the legal definition, then everybody looks to that definition. If the jury is just, okay, plain meaning, you know, choose it. Is it, you know, residential as opposed to commercial, or is it some other term? So I think it did leave enough ambiguity that it couldn't be viewed as harmless error. Okay.
Ms. Brown, we used up some of your rebuttal time with our questions, so we'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. And Ms. Clark, if you'd add an extra minute to Mr. Casper's time, please.
Afternoon, may it please the court and counsel. I am Richard B. Casper, Deputy District Attorney of the Douglas County District Attorney's Office. I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada. In this case, I do want to make, I know there were a lot of, and Ms. Brown spent some time talking about the facts, and I just want to make clear that I think this court appreciates that this is not a sufficiency of evidence case. I'm not going to stand here and try to cite a litany of facts, but rather, I would like this court to know.
Well, we're not arguing it for that reason.
I'm sorry.
We're not arguing it for that reason either. Let's get to the heart of it. The issue in this case is the judge was asked to provide a definition of the word reside to the jury, and that instruction would suggest that it needed to be a continuous and permanent residence of the victim in this case. And when you look at various dictionary definitions of the word reside, they all seem to suggest that that's a proper definition that should be given. Why shouldn't we define reside in that manner?
Well, there, thank you. There, this court certainly, if it chose to, we'll start with that, could rule that the reside should be given a certain definition, and a definition that's never been given. This court has never reached out and created a definition. The legislature didn't create a definition. The statute that was a home invasion statute, it wasn't drawn, as far as I can tell, from any existing statute. And so we don't have that. We have just what the legislature decided to do. And the legislature decided that it wouldn't give it a definition, not a technical legal definition. Instead, it decided that it would give, it certainly knows how to give technical definitions in that statute. It did so. It knew how to give inhabited dwelling a definition, forcible entry. It gave it a specific definition. But it decided, in the wisdom of the legislature, that no, instead, these other words don't need a definition. That, in fact, in the statutory interpretation would suggest that when there's not a technical legal definition given, and I want to talk about that because this court has also held that the common understanding of the word is what is used. And in fact, for a couple of reasons, at least two reasons, the district court in this case did not abuse its broad discretion in refusing to give the jury instruction that was proposed by Ms. Brown, by the defendant in this case. First of all, because of controlling precedent, the Dawes case from 1994, I would suggest that this case falls squarely under the precedent that this court put forward in Dawes, in which, in that case, it was an involuntary manslaughter case, and the individual was charged with principal involuntary manslaughter for engaging in reckless driving. In fact, what was a speed contest. And in that case, the state was required to prove the element of reckless driving as defined under that statute. There's a few different theories of reckless driving, but in that case, there's a specific theory of engaging in a speed contest. And in fact, the defendant in that case asked, very similar to this case, asked for an instruction defining the term speed contest. The district court declined to do that, said it's subject to its common understanding. And that was upheld by this court, so that was actually appropriate. Despite the fact that in that case, the jurors actually, after some deliberation, had sent a note out to the district court asking, is there a definition for this term? And the Supreme Court upheld the district court's decision. And I would suggest that there is no daylight between the circumstance that we have here and the circumstance that was in Dawes. In fact, if anything, if you're looking at a continuum of words, words that are more technical and legal, words that are more commonly understood, I would suggest the speed contest falls more on the side of a technical term than does the word reside. If you go and you talk to somebody on the street, where are you residing these days? Where is your son residing? People don't look at you like you're from outer space. Like they don't understand what you're talking about. There's a common understanding.
How do you deal with, like, let's say celebrities that have five homes or something like that, and they probably reside around to the five homes over the various times. Is there an unlimited number of residences you could have to still qualify under the statute?
I suggest that, again, as the word is present in the statute, meaning it doesn't give any limitation. In fact, as long as jurors believe that that constitutes living in a place, residing in a place, and you could reside at more than one place. For example, you left these situations. For example, Justice Hardesty brought up the vacation home situation. But there are situations where maybe you're an Airbnb, you're spending a week at a place. Do you give up the residence where you work? So if somebody breaks in where your more permanent home is, that a home invasion? What if you're sleeping there at that new residence? You've been there a few days, but you're going to leave the next day you're sleeping and someone breaks in. You're going to say that's not a home invasion because there was no permanency. You were about to leave. You've only been there a couple of days. I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios that under the statutes and with the terms that are given, and I agree with Justice Hardesty, these terms that are there, there's a transparency, that's kind of implicit in these terms.
Well, it kind of begs the question, could you, if there isn't some definition or understanding of how reside is being used in the context of this statute, it could make a huge difference on whether home invasion could be committed, for example, on an unoccupied apartment that's listed for rent but not currently occupied by anybody. Could there be a home? Does that exclude home invasion in that context? Or take the Airbnb example where it's available for use, but it's not currently being used. So if there's a break-in, similar to what Mr. Dunham did here, he broke the window, he goes in, I guess he was inebriated, and he and his shotgun go walking in, he falls asleep. So if you did that in an empty apartment or maybe the tent's empty that night. You're not there that night, but you're there the next night. Do we have home invasion only when people are around? It seems like the legislature was concerned about separate crimes. When people are present, you might have burglary. When they're not there, if it's a residence, you've got home invasion.
And I would point out...
Could I interject here? I'm sorry, it's difficult with the time delay, but... The facts in this case were that Skripko was not living in the condo, right? She was preparing it to be rented. So Justice Hardesty's remarks about a rental are apt in this case, correct?
So in response to that, I would say that Justice Hardesty's comments are certainly apt. I did want to throw in a few facts about that, though, as it's been described. So what the testimony was at trial was that, and I think Ms. Brown went over this, that yes, it was a condominium that was in her name. There had been times when she had stayed there more often than others. She had stayed there more often, certainly at the beginning of 2016 and near the, in the summer. In fact, in the summer, I think, from August 29th to October 21st, she stated she wasn't there, so I think there's another consideration here that's important in this factual circumstance. It wasn't that she stated that she didn't want to be there. In fact, she said there had been a protection order issued, and she was afraid of having a confrontation with Mr. Dunham, who she believed to be, and as Ms. Brown stated, in fact, was there the entire summer. So in essence, she had been, displaced from access to that place because of the presence of Mr. Dunham. And what also needs to be clear is that she did go back. It wasn't like that was the last time she was ever at the condominium. On October 21st. She stated that she'd been there in November. She said she was there the weekend before the trial. She says it wasn't being rented out until, I think she said, at the earliest in December of 2016. So it was not actually a rental at that time. It was still her residence. It was still being used as a residence. It was still furnished. There's bedding, there's all kinds of things. It's kind of, I can go in and sleep there whenever I want. It's my second home. So the idea that at some point she was going to make this into a rental, I would suggest that the jury heard evidence that at this point it had not been converted into that type of situation at that point.
Well, would the, my understanding is a defendant is entitled to an instruction if it comports with the law that fairly represents his or her theory of the case. And as I understand this defendant's theory of the case, it was that she had changed this in her mind to being totally a commercial rental kind of a property, I understand what you're saying. There's some evidence to support what you're saying, but if you credit the argument that she just owned it as a rental and had made that change in her mind, would that be a residence for purposes of home invasion? If I just own a house up at Lake Tahoe as a rental and I hope to make money renting it, yes, go ahead.
I would suggest that if she had, in essence, abandoned the property as a residence, as a place that she believed that she would have an absolute right to enter, and I think that there's, we see some of that language from this court in the burglary context where we talk about whether you can burglarize your home, whether you have an absolute right to go in. I think if she had given that up by, you know, making it more of a commercial property and making it into a rental, I would suggest that certainly if she no longer resided there, now someone else could reside there. It's still a residence in the sense that people live there. But you're asking if she herself continues to reside there, if she's converted it into some kind of, I'm no longer having the intent to live there, I'm just renting it out, I'm not going to enter there, you know, except for the landlord under those type of circumstances. You know, I'm not going to stand here and say that that's...
Does it matter, Mr. Casper, whether that this offense resides in the property crime section as opposed to the offense against persons crime section, so that the focus on this word should be how it's used, not necessarily by the owner, but that is in the language, or other lawful occupant, like a tenant or something. So if it's available to be used as a residence.
That's exactly what I think is, yes, Your Honor, to answer your question, a yes to that. And I did want to make the point because there's some suggestion that...
So let's assume that that's an appropriate way to define this. Under our rules of statutory construction, how does one, assuming we resolved this case and did an opinion, or you were drafting an opinion in this case, how would you approach the rules of statutory construction in an opinion that defines the word resides in the manner in which I just suggested? Because it doesn't seem to be ambiguous, but maybe it is. There is no legislative history, none that we could find, and the parties haven't suggested that I can see.
There is some legislative history, Your Honor, and I know that's not in the briefs, but there is. And the statute was passed in 1989, and it's AB 593. And I'm happy to address a little bit of that as well.
Go ahead.
So I think Your Honor's already pointed to some things, the plain language of the statute, some of the way it encompasses so many different places that could count as home invasion, the fact that it's in a property section of the statute. The legislative history, in fact, when it was first proposed, included there actually was a different definition for inhabited dwelling when it was first proposed, and it included that someone remained, they have to be there continuously. I don't have the exact thing. They have to be there continuously for 60. That was almost immediately stricken and taken out and changed to, it's actually changed twice.
But is there any explanation, any testimony as to why that language was?
No, there's not. There's not. But I would suggest that the fact that they took that out, it is further evidence that they didn't want to create some kind of hard line, temporal, you know, at this, you have to be there for a certain amount of time in order to become a resident. They didn't want that in there. They took it out completely. They didn't replace it with any other kind of temporal time frame at all. So I would suggest that the fact that they took it out, the fact that they know how to make definitions, and the fact that that statute did give them that, they didn't want to create some kind of special technical definition when they created that situation. So that's what I'm suggesting. And I'm suggesting that, I think there are a lot of definitions of reside. Some are more technical than others. I agree with that. You know, you look in different contexts and you see different things. The fact that the legislature didn't decide to use one of those when they wrote this out, I think, is telling in and of itself. And you see words that are more like domicile, I think. Sometimes we talk about the word domicile, which in a legal context has a very more specific meaning. They didn't decide to use that kind of word. They decided to use a word that, like, as I said, people use on every day. You know, it's not an uncommon word to use every day, and people just kind of understand what they mean when we're talking about it. Now, I did want to touch, I've got very little time, but on the idea that the defense was entitled to this instruction somehow. I did at least want to address that quickly, and Crawford is, I think, the case that's relied upon by the defense. I would suggest that Crawford doesn't apply here, that, in fact, the defendant is entitled to certain instructions of certain kinds, and that's when it goes to the theory of their case. And, in fact, the instruction that's in Crawford is the kind of instruction that I'm talking about, in which there's an element of the crime that the state has to prove, and the defense wants to emphasize. And they use this word, emphasize, a lot in that instruction. The defense wants to give emphasis to the fact that the state has to prove this certain thing, and that the court then should be obligated to give that instruction as long as it's a correct statement of the law. Well, in this case, the instruction that was proffered, as I suggested earlier, falls squarely under Dawes and doesn't fall under that kind of theory. If Ms. Brown had asked for an instruction that said, in fact, there was an instruction on inhabited dwelling, the jury had it. The jury had a list of elements, one of which was inhabited dwelling. There was an instruction that said the state had to prove all those elements. And there was an instruction as to what was inhabited dwelling. She had every right to ask for an instruction, for example, that said, if you have reasonable doubt as to whether this was an inhabited dwelling, then you shall find the defendant, you must find the defendant not guilty. That's the kind of instruction that, thank you, I appreciate your time.
You want to finish your thought?
Well, that's the kind of instruction that is in Crawford. That's the kind of thing. And in fact, I would just suggest that Ms. Brown did have an instruction on inhabited dwelling. She wanted, and she had every opportunity and to go to address that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Brown, you have 2 minutes and 5 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. I think one thing to note is that in the statutes, there's the home invasion charge that has the requirement of both forceful entry and that it be inhabited. There's another statute, NRS 205.2813, which is entering an, basically called housebreaking, I think. It's entering an uninhabited or vacant building. It's a lesser offense, but it, again, requires forceful entry. And in this case, and under that statute, it requires some other intent to take over that property as your residence. But so it's looking, I think, even in the statutes, they distinguish between inhabited and uninhabited. And they, with uninhabited, they use the term vacant. If a person is not, I mean, you could have maybe, you know, 6 houses. 5 of them are going to be vacant. You're living in one. But I think there is a distinguishment between if Ms. Skripko used her house in Monterey as her primary residence, and this was bought on the idea that it was going to be a vacation home, but during the time frame, she visited that very often, and she testified by August 2016, her plans for the future for that residence were to have it as a rental property. And she hired Mr. Latosse to start doing repair work on it because it needed to be brought up to standards the realtor wanted for it to be a rental property. So had Mr. Dunham not been there occasionally, that building would have been vacant. It would have been uninhabited. And so the only thing that would distinguish it from an uninhabited building is if Ms. Skripko had some kind of interest, some kind of home interest in that part of that condominium. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs in this case, and we will case a